Jared, you never had the urge to get choked out by a twink in fishnets?
Nope, can't say that I have.
Thursday night.
Speaking of which, are we still hanging out?
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
What have you been up to this week, boys? Been on a bit of a break ourselves. We released one of our special episodes in the interim.
Admittedly, not all that much. Just pretty hectic couple weeks at work. I think you have much more exciting things that you've done.
Yeah, a couple of things. Like, I went to the LVO competition for tabletop gaming. It's like the world's largest tabletop gaming convention for Warhammer, Infinity. They've got rooms for Star Wars Legion, Marvel Crisis Protocols. Like, they run out a bigger convention hall just for their, like, ancillary vendors than most people do for their whole events. So it's quite the pilgrimage to go out there. People come with their Kickstarter games and games that they're trying out, trying to get off the ground, and have people test them, see, like, beta cast stuff. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun.
Producer's note, Cody doesn't say it, but he won 19th place in Worlds for Warhammer Age of Sigmar, as well as Best in Faction for his dinosaur riding lizardman. But as for me, I watched a lot of Agito.
Yeah, are you done with your run-through of our next victim series?
Yes.
Oh. How long is Agito compared to Kuga?
2 episodes longer.
Hell yeah. And does it take place, like, after Kuga or before Kuga?
So Agito, it's the second Heisei era Kamen Rider. It is slightly connected to Kuga, as I understand it.
It's complicated. We'll get to it when we start.
That's fair enough. Well, I understand we have some intense episodes coming up, if everything producer Jed has hinted at seems to be true. Jared, have you had enough time to grieve your losses? Ready to move on?
I am. Okay. Yes. He will live on in my heart.
And your scarf.
I should get a scarf.
Shall we get started then?
Do you not have a Will It Grong?
Oh, I guess I could do mine for this week. So, it's a little out there, but I was thinking a jellyfish. I know we don't have a whole lot of invertebrate grongi. We have insects, that sort of thing, but in terms of, like, true invertebrates, mollusks, and that sort of thing, we had a squid, so I was thinking maybe a jellyfish. Now, obviously, a jellyfish is going to be, you know, poison-based or kind of some physiological reaction. We've already established that the grongi are capable of sending people into anaphylactic shock by shooting them through the skull with darts. So we, you know, have characters that can send people into rapid anaphylaxis, and I think that would be a pretty cool method of murder. So I was thinking this one could, like, get into the water supply and take out, like, whole buildings worth of people at the time. Got way too many tassels. I like to think that's the affectation, just tassels where you don't need tassels. Tassels everywhere. Tassel city.
Even more fringe than the saddest of clowns?
Fringe in directions you can't possibly conceive.
Non-Euclidean fringe?
Non-Euclidean fringe.
There was a jellyfish. Killed by Titan form between episodes 22 and 23.
I got one.
You did. Per the Grongadex, his name, or her name, since we have no idea, is Megaguragi.
Rest in phlegm.
So with that, why don't we get to it? We are watching episodes 34 and 35, Tremble and Emotion.
I am currently trembling with emotion. It's not the one you think.
David Cage would be so thrilled.
Episodes 34 and 35 were written by Arakawa Naruhisa and directed by Ishida Hidenori. They originally aired October 1st and 8th, 2000. Producers note, be warned, especially if watching along with us, these episodes contain gore and the psychological torture of teenagers. They are heavy and intense. A jump to the sky turns to a writer review.
Did we drop off and pick up a different anime? Because this episode felt dark.
This is drastically different tonally than the rest of the series up till this point.
Yeah, we've said a couple of times that it feels like we're coming up on the end of things, but that really you know, seems to be kicking into high gear here.
I mean, after this, there's 15 episodes left.
Yeah.
Let's take this from the top.
Show enough.
So we start off at the Miura General Hospital, and, this isn't where we usually are.
Yeah, it's not our normal band of misfits.
And already the lighting and the camera work is doing a real good job of setting us on ease.
Yeah, just atmospherically, this felt different right off the rip.
Because we've got a slow, down-tilted upwards tracking shot across the hospital room to a bed that's curtained off, and there's some nurses peeking in. And there's a family in there. Mom, dad, and daughter are looking at the bed, and the boy is hunched over, covered in a blanket. He starts saying, "I'm next." He said I was going to die in 4 days. And he sits up and he's holding his phone and he's looking at the day and time. And his family's like, "No, that's ridiculous. You're not going to die. Nothing's going to happen."
Important to note, the kid seems terrified but perfectly healthy. Like, yes. He's got all his color, he's sweaty and anxious, but he looks perfectly healthy.
And he starts listing off names of other people, like his classmates. "He got this person, that person, this. I'm next." He's overcome with emotion, head in hands, screams, and as he lifts back up, there's blood on his hand and blood trickling down his nose, which causes him to panic even more and lunge at his dad, saying, "You know, I don't want to die." And the camera cuts to outside the room, and they're screaming, and someone comes running out trying to get a nurse, as Ichijo comes walking in from the other end of the hall. He stops outside the door, hears a bit more of the commotion. I forget the name for the medical machinery, but, like, you hear him flatline.
EKG.
Thank you. And for a brief moment, you see someone standing behind Ichijo in the distance.
Looking nonchalant as fuck.
Almost like he's chewing on something, because he's got his fingers up to his
chewing his
mouth,
maybe? Yeah.
But also, he's grainy. Like, a distinct drop in camera quality when we look at him. We've joked before about, like, AT Fields. Yeah, this feels like the show responding, being like, "You want AT Field? I'll give you AT Field."
Like a found footage horror villain.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to analog horror.
Reminded me of that old Mitch Hedberg bit where he was talking about Bigfoot. He's like, "I don't think Bigfoot, just people can't get a picture of him. I think he's inherently out of focus. We have a large, grainy, out-of-focus monster roaming the countryside. We can see the character clearly sometimes, but then we see the character, this new Grongi, from the perspective of others, and it's always grainy and out of focus. Lensing looks different. And there's a sound, too."
Yeah, there is a sound associated with him, and all of it just continues throughout this episode to build this unease about him that we haven't quite seen before on another Grongi.
No.
We get the opening credits, and after that, we're outside Polpol, and Godai and Nana are waxing the beat chaser.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not a euphemism.
No, it's not. That is genuinely, in fact, what is happening. Remember, Godai has zero interest in Nana.
Godai has zero interest in women.
That too.
Yeah.
But especially her.
No to women, two no's for you. He likes boys. He does.
So Nana's asking him why he got the bike. And he's like, "Oh, well, my old one got damaged and needs repair, so they gave me this one." Wait, they gave it to you? Yeah. Isn't this expensive? And Godai has never once considered how much a motorcycle like this might cost. Because he goes, I bet.
You know, it just might be.
"While he's stupid, he is very cute. That's why we name him Himbo."
They go inside, and Pops has laid out two plates of curry with gold leaf in them, just like he said he had wanted to. And he says it is in celebration of ULF4 having a full set of gold-trimmed forms now. He is the biggest Kuga fanboy.
He is. Pop is simultaneously paying the most attention and the least attention.
Yes.
He has min-maxed his observational skills.
And they're like, well, what's this? And Pops gives his reasoning, and he says that he's going to call it the Sterling Curry. And Goda's like, hey, Pops, isn't Sterling associated with silver?
Pops has a slight mental hiccup and gently dissociates until the scene is over.
He does. The phone rings, Godai goes and picks it up, and it's Ichijo. And Godai's like, okay, I'll be right there.
Oh, thank God you saved me from an awkward social situation.
We cut to police headquarters, and Ichijo walks into the conference room, and he's greeted. They're discussing that 21 victims happened on one day, 22 the next, 23 the day after that, all of them male second-year students at one particular school.
78 people in total.
Out of, they said, 91 total students, 78 of them are dead. Ooh.
Yeah.
This is, we can go ahead and guess that the game is to kill these students specifically. So, 91, that's a reasonable kill count as far as a Gurungi game goes.
It is.
And I have to wonder his time limit, because the most we've ever seen is like 72 hours, but we find out the kill method is he does something, 4 days later they die, and now there's been 3 days worth of deaths.
Yeah.
So we're on day 6?
Something like that? 6 or 7.
Yeah. The longest game we've encountered so far?
Another interesting thing about these episodes is where they choose to drop us into the investigation. We're not here at the first murders that pop up. We're here several days along. So clearly, like, the police haven't figured out anything yet. They're still on respond to the call mode. That's where they're at. Which is intimidating in and of itself, because think about how fast they put some of these cases together. But here we are with our, you know, Samara from the Ring style 7 days killings. But it's really interesting that they've made no progress so far, and here we are in the middle of them catching up to that fact. There's kids are dying, and it doesn't seem like they can do anything about it.
Sugita comes in, throws his coat down on the chair, has a brief talk with Ichijo.
Did you mention his swagger? Because he had so much swagger after he got to fire the big gun. He saunters in with his coat over one shoulder.
Well, it was Sakurai who fired the gun. It seems that we will regretfully never see 2.5 hour car ride chat with Godai has
it
left him
to do
feeling
wonders.
A certain way.
Yeah, no, like he walked in like he just got done with like 6 months of therapy. He was shoulders held high, you know?
And he says to Ichijo, you know, I never thought that ULF4 would be someone like him.
Dreamy, isn't he?
And as they're starting to talk about this, Ichijo gets a phone call. And, hey, it's Kamayama. He's still in the show. And he says that there's been some killings in Nagano, but we don't get to hear the rest of the phone call.
Yeah, the police in the background are frantic.
We actually get to see a shot of Kamayama in the Nagano Prefecture Police Department as he ends the phone call. We then cut to Jonin University, and a new portion of the text has been translated.
It says all of it.
I feel like we have seen that before.
No, this time with feeling, Jared.
Sakurako says she's identified what the symbols mean, but now it's translating with cultural context and such.
Okay, so
getting some clarification.
A much deeper understanding of the text. And as they're starting to talk about this, because Jean's there too, looking a bit more put together than he has. He's on wearing a collared shirt again.
He's recovered from his long nights with
Inakita.
Yeah, I guess since their affair is over, he's not staying up all night. He's getting a little more sleep, dressing a little nicer, you know.
Who knows? Maybe their relationship's actually turning more positive and he's feeling better about himself now.
Damn, we're very different people.
Anyway, Sakurako gets a phone call, and it's Ichijo, and we don't hear his side of the conversation. But when she hangs up, She's like, so I'm going to Nagano. There's been some killings there. Ichijo wants me to look into them.
And she's got a lot of trepidation here, too. Like, she's clearly unsettled.
Well, she does specifically mention that these killings have happened near the dig site where all of this started. So, certainly, that's dredging up some maybe not quite fully healed wounds. And Jean does look concerned for her.
Concerned in French.
And then we cut to the forest.
Just like the rest of us who played Tears of the Kingdom of Breath of the Wild, Baruba seems to be lost in the freaking Korok forest.
Yeah, they've really ramped up the green filter over everything. Mm-hmm. And this entire scene, which goes for, what, 15, 20 seconds maybe?
Solid, yeah.
Is her just walking, staring straight ahead.
And like slow filter, like a 90s grunge rock music video too. Just like I could hear with arms wide open in the background.
She's clearly lost in feelings that I don't think maybe even she knew she had.
James Dean's gone.
We all feel Bada's loss.
I swear to God, I want her to never reappear. I just want every episode to have like 15 seconds of her wandering through some random frickin' forest. Just like, she got lost. She's not relevant anymore. Like, the Grongi don't know where she is.
It's implied that they don't.
Yeah.
Later on. So, we then cut to the preschool, and Minori and Keiko are walking on the front porch while some Muppets play in the yard.
Oh, the Muppets.
Keiko discusses feeling the baby kick and move, but she does not look that much more pregnant than she did last time.
Big whoop. Tell us when it henshins.
The look on your face as you disagree with me.
She's really pregnant now.
Yeah, she's quite pregonical. Mm.
And they look in through the window, and they see two kids staring down at each other and a block tower in between them. And the kid on the right kicks the blocks.
Rattail Philip, we're going to call him.
He has an actual name that is
Rattail Philip.
Rattail Philip kicks the box.
Got him.
Shudo, I think, is his name.
Yes, it is. It's Shudo.
Prosciutto?
Not prosciutto. Just...
Is he named after ham because he's fat?
Cancel him.
How did you get multilingually offensive?
Gotta get up very early in the morning, Jared. So anyway, Prosciutto kicks over the tower.
They watch him kick the tower and go over and open a book and just start reading. They're staring in through the window like, ah, we're gonna have to do something about this.
Oh, damn, time to be the adult.
Then we cut to the autopsy theater.
Still
ankle
flooded.
Deep in water.
Ichijou's got his normal shoes on.
He is standing on like a little bridge walkway thing that's like right on water level.
Why is that necessary?
Because he's not wearing wading boots like Tsubaki is.
He's still got dead guy juice on his feet.
And Tsubaki is digging around inside the head of this person. And he informs Ichijou that he's found the cause of death, and he pulls something out and drops it in a tray. And Ichijou picks up the tray and looks at it, and it's a pretty wicked-looking barb.
Broken piece of a Beyblade.
And Tsubaki says, you know, like, something this size, this shape, could not just wind up in a person's brain without surgery.
Yeah.
And that while the people were alive, that they were taken through CT scans and MRIs, and there was nothing in their heads.
And then poof, weird little stabby knife.
So he's hypothesizing that something entered their body from somewhere else, something that just doesn't show up on any, you know, X-ray, CT, MRI, anything like that, made its way to their head, into their skull, and then, like, unfolded into the blade and killed them that way? That's gruesome.
Yeah, Tsubaki seems properly disturbed by this.
As anyone in their right mind would be.
Mm-hmm.
And much like us, Ichijo is left with questions that are really concerning that we have to raise. And he states as much.
We have 78 casualties, and they're just now figuring out proper cause of death. And even the cause of death they figured out doesn't make any sense.
You know, even with the owl pellets, they figured that out pretty quickly. Entered through the shoulder, went to the heart, caused them to go into cardiac arrest. You know, Sea Snake hit with a whip so cold that it instantly put them in... There's a lot of cardiac arrest now that I'm realizing it for the goes.
Ever seen Death Note?
Nah, that's fair. I just thought that was lazy writing, but...
To be fair, most deaths happen when the heart stops.
Yes. I realize. So we cut back to the preschool, and I'm glad to know that some things are a constant in life. You know, there is always laundry to do, and Godai will always get swarmed by Moppets.
It's a constant in the universe.
They're so happy to see him. But there is one kid sitting over at the piano with Minori, and he's not looking particularly happy. And it's the, not Shuda, the other kid from the confrontation earlier.
The one whose tower was kicked over. The one not named after Ham.
Hiroki, I believe.
Thank you.
Sure.
And Godai comes up, and he's done like a cat's cradle sort of thing with a piece of string, and he's going... I'm sorry for those of you listening to this in headphones. That probably was uncomfortable just then, but I had to.
Yeah.
And he jokes with Hiroki about it being a mosquito. And he claps his hands together and he pulls the string apart. And it's just, you know, a regular piece of string, cat's cradle sort of trick. He claps his hands again and opens them up and the string's gone. Ha, huh, sleight of hand magic.
Which one of those was skill 608? Was it the sleight of hand magic to make the string disappear? Was it the cat's cradle? Ability to make animals and objects out of the string? Which one of those was 608?
Yes.
The implications that multiple skills can be bound up under one skill umbrella and he has 2,000s of them implies a catalog of knowledge that rivals the Library of Alexandria in this homeless man's head.
I was going to say that the skill was actually the mosquito noise he was making, but I like yours and the existential dread it causes better.
God damn it.
And Godai's doing his best to cheer up Hiroki, and he says he'll go talk to the other kid. And he goes outside, and he finds Shudo.
Shudo, yes.
Cancel him.
He goes outside, and he finds Shudo throwing a ball against the inside side of the little playground tower that he's in. And he's talking to him, and he's like, so I heard you kicked over that tower.
Hey, buddy. It wasn't nice.
Shudo's like, he started it, and Godai's like, oh? Because from what I heard, you started it. And Shudo says that Hiroki came up and changed the tower from the way that Shudo had built it, and it made him mad. And, oh no, moral complexity with our preschoolers.
Maybe Prejudo's not a dick.
I'm about to cancel you my damn self.
What? I tried to go with Rat Tail Phillip, and you didn't like that.
I didn't have a problem with it. Jared did.
I didn't really have a problem. I just made a face because it's a funny name.
Okay, well, we can go back to Rat Tail Phillip so you can stop canceling me. Make fun of him for something preventable, not his weight.
That's true. They could just cut the rat tail off.
You could just cut the rat tail off. It's right. A choice.
But I think it's there to imply delinquency.
Jared, it reaches back to where his fucking shoulder blades touch. It's been a choice for a while.
He's 6.
Had it since he was 4. Been a delinquent the whole time.
We established back during Garima Ba's episode that a child could be found guilty of tax evasion.
The minute he could toddle, he got his first comb switchblade. It was all downhill from there.
It is worth noting, while they're having this conversation, the comm on the beat chaser is going off, and Godai is kind of like looking back, being like, oh, I should take that.
Yeah. This is also like the first time a kid, like any character, has not responded positively to Godai's like beloved stoogery. He can generally get some kind of reaction. This kid doesn't even look at him.
Godai is finally like, why don't you just try talking to him next time? I have to go.
No response from the kid.
And he gets to the bike, and Seichijo saying that ULF might have been spotted. He's like, where do I need to go? And he takes off, and for a moment I thought he was going to Henshin in front of the children.
No, he runs out front, drives away a brief time until he gets into a crowded intersection, and Henshin's there in front of everyone.
I just realized that I combined the two preschool scenes together. We cut briefly to Koganai, and we're seeing a funeral procession for the kid from the very start of the episode. And Sakurai's there just sort of observing. Security detail, I'm guessing, because clearly the other students from the high school are there paying their respects for their classmate. And one of the kids has a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, we see like a flash of like kind of what he's seeing. But important to note, he grabbed his head and observed a figure, same figure that we saw with Ichijo earlier, across the fence, across the street, and then grabs his head even harder and sinks down to the ground.
Gojo Ijida was played by Okawa Masayoshi. His name comes from Yamarashi, meaning porcupine.
Sakurai runs up, is like, is everything okay? And he points out Jalaji. Is like, he comes to all of the funerals.
We get a flash of his vision, seeing the figure still standing there, with the weird filtering and audio effect. And then Sakurai turns to look at the same area, and we have no filter, normal vision, and more importantly, nobody there.
Yeah. We cut to, I guess, the new Gorongi layer for this week.
Now in purple.
Now in purple, and fog and industrial?
Industrial grade flooring.
Yeah.
Multi-level? Moving up in the world? Getting fancier?
Godol's reading something. Zelazu is sort of pacing around, and she asks where Baruba is. Because, again, I guess no one knows she wandered off into the woods never to be seen again.
Mm-hmm.
And Godol says that with the death of Bada, they have to rethink the game. So was everyone hinging on Bada completing his?
We only have two that we know of left.
Well, three. Godol's gotta compete himself, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
Producer's note, I was forgetting Jalaji of all people. I'm an idiot.
And so Zelazu's like, well, I wonder what kind of game I should play. Implying she has no faith in her Gorongi with benefits? Jalaji? Goma makes a comment, and she's like, I'm not going to take advice from a zoo like you, and smacks him.
And then he rears up and fucking pops back at her.
He stands up for himself for the first time.
Made physical contact with her, too. Like,
and he says, you know, you've yet to see my abilities. And this takes them so aback. Godol switches into his monster form. You know, barrels forward and is like, oh, and what is that exactly?
Mm-hmm. Stampy stompies and, like, the lighting change. We now have strobe lights. He cuts a pretty intimidating silhouette, I'm not gonna lie.
So, now cutting back to Godai getting on the bike to leave the preschool. As Ichijo is feeding him information, he gets a call from Nozomi, who gives two important pieces of information. The first is that one of the kids who's under medical watch in the hospital jumped out the window because he did not want to wait for his inevitable death.
Yeah, he opted out.
And Godai brings up the question, is like, so that wouldn't count for the game, right? And Ichijo doesn't outright say it, but clearly thinking, how would I know that? There was a somewhat recent transfer student to the class. And Ichijo's like, send everyone to go guard him.
Yep. He is clearly on the chopping block.
And we get a bit more of a radio conversation with Godai saying, I'll head that way too. We get a little bit more information. Sakurai calls in and says that they tried to make contact with the family. They've left for a vacation home elsewhere. And Ichijo tells him to get in contact with the local provisional police there to, you know, start guarding till the actual ULF force can get there. We then cut to a subway station Nagano. And Sakurako has gotten off the train, and she is being met by Kameyama, and...
This is Suayama Kanako, portrayed by Mino Yukako.
They discuss some, you know, quick pleasantries, and then Kanako says that, you know, this is a bit of a case here. And then we cut to a house in Hakone. It's up on a hill, and the transfer student, Kazuya, and his family are all sitting on the couch, very nervous.
Trembling, one might say.
The title. Yes. And the mom's trying to calm Kazuya down. And's like, there's no way that anything would follow us out here. And the phone rings.
Bum, bum, bum.
They all kind of shriek at it, and the dad, with trembling hand, finally reaches out and picks up the phone and slowly brings it up. Doesn't say anything. Nothing else is said on the other line either.
They're trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty.
That's be real horrifying.
Those are the real Gronki amongst us.
And then that weird noise starts. And they look up, and Jalaji is standing outside the door, staring in, looking like he's chewing on his fingernail again.
Playing creepy peekaboo.
The camera work in this scene actually kind of started to make me feel a little dizzy.
Yeah.
Because between the motions of the camera, the noise that it's making, the shots of the dad spinning, and Jalaji appearing here and there and everywhere, and eventually the dad goes and picks up a gun. And he tells Kazuya and the mom to go upstairs. And he's trying to get a clear shot, and all of a sudden he hears a scream from up on the loft, and he looks up, and Jalaji's standing there looking in through the second story window, and he fires, and Jalaji doesn't even move.
Yeah, you see where the bullets impact the glass. They impact very, very close, and Jalaji doesn't flinch.
He just sort of tilts his head, looks in for a moment, and is gone again.
Important to note, we're constantly throughout the course of the scene getting flashes of this clearly distorted image and audio that the dad is getting as he's trying to process this, inner shot with clear images of like where Jalaji actually is. So like the dad will like look out a window in the direction he thought he saw him, and Jalaji's just like right behind him or behind a different one laughing at him while he's looking at the wrong window.
Emotional damage!
trauma.
We hear sirens start to come from the distance, and the mom makes a comment about the police are here. The sirens continue, but like no one's running up. And we get a quick shot outside, and there's just a cop laying limp outside his car. Somehow, while still terrorizing this family, Jalaji killed him. Unless there's another Gorongi here, but we didn't see another.
We'd like to see multitasking in our villains, you know?
The dad finally comes outside with the gun, and Jalaji just grabs him and chokes him.
Yeah. The dad clearly sees him in one, is coming outside to deal with the image that he sees, and Jalaji is just leaning against the wall next to him. Casual, doesn't get in a hurry, just reaches out and starts to choke him.
And Kazuya and mom take a moment to try and bolt. They go down the stairs to the ground, and of course, Kazuya keeps tripping over his own feet, trying to get away. And they get backed up against some rocks, and the mom is screaming at Jalaji, "Why are you doing this?" And he says, "The more you suffer, the more fun it is." This is a level of sadism that we haven't quite seen. We may have come close. Galma Ray had a bit of a sadistic streak to him.
We've seen, like, callous disregard for life and the Gronki not really viewing humans as worth noting. But this actively taking pleasure in instilling fear and instilling pain is different.
You're right. Galma enjoyed terrorizing others and being like, you can't stop me. Jalajis is, I enjoy actively making you suffer.
Yep.
This is the point where he turns into his monster form.
Yeah. He turns into his monster form about the same time this family forgets any kind of self-preservation skills and just cowers against a rock that's their waist height.
His monster form is mostly black but with white head spines for hair and some bone jewelry.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about this one because this one does have minimalist colors, but the stark contrast in colors does a lot.
But as he's about to stab with his fingers or something.
He's got a necklace on that's got a bunch of little sharp doodads on it.
Guess that's what he's transmuting. As he goes to reach for one of those, another time-honored tradition as...
Oh. And his name is John C!
Bike! Bike slap. Bike slap.
Oh, yeah. Godai mad. He hits this guy with the bike 3 or 4 times.
Godai ain't mad yet.
Tease.
Jalaji takes off running. Godai follows on the bike, and at some point during the chase, switches to dragon form, rips a branch off of a tree, turns it into the dragon rod, stands up on the bike right as it's cresting onto the plateau that Jalaji is on, leaps off, goes to do Splash Dragon, end of episode.
Mm-hmm. I'm super excited.
This is intense. Let's see how it ends.
No fear, no pain.
I insist there has been a significant amount of fear and not insignificant amount of pain these episodes.
This was a different show.
Yeah.
Let's just take it from the top.
Mm-hmm.
We start the episode off right where we left off. Godai jumping off the bike, trying to do Splash Dragon against Jalaji, but... Jalaji's just not there when he hits the ground.
Yeah, we've got to discuss some of these power sets because, like, we got no clarification on how his worked, and now he's Audi 5000. Like, the snaps, it seemed like he was creating audiovisual, like, after images. But I know, like, porcupines, you mentioned earlier that porcupines will, like, rattle their quills, and that disorients predators. Like, that's what it's meant to do. But it's a bit of a stretch to go from that to, you know, imagining that as a literal able to summon after images of yourself. I don't know, but this one, I liked it. It was a very menacing character, but I don't know that it really screamed porcupine to me.
The method of kill does, but yeah, I don't know what... Is it audiovisual hallucinations? Is it a form of super speed? How does...
Actually, you know what? That's on me. I just pulled it up on Google. Turns out all porcupines are able to teleport and have an inherent lust for human blood. So this is it's right on the money.
I need you to cite your sources in this one instance, please.
My sources, I made it the fuck up, Raiden.
Thank you.
Senator.
Jalaji is now a great distance away, rips a bunch of the little barbs off of his necklace. They effectively turn into kunai and he throws them, and Godai gets a non-consensual acupuncture session.
Yeah, he was looking like Ace Ventura in the second Ace Ventura movie. He goes down just jabbed a bunch with darts.
The only way our audience will get that is if they are our age group, which I think they mostly are.
I just saw them with the fucking thing sticking out of him in every direction. I just... heard Jim Carrey go, 3 darts is too much.
We need to laugh while we can.
Yeah, we're getting it in now. So both in human form and in monster form now, we've observed, you know, the Pokepork chewing on their own fingernails to the point where the monster form has bloody cuticles. Like, yeah, it's got claws, but like the cuticles on all of the fingers are bloody. And we haven't seen Jalaji draw blood with the claws in this episode. So it's either still on there, or that's from him chewing his own cuticles till they bleed.
There is a comment made about his personality that kind of lends to the idea that he would be chewing his nails down to the nub.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. We get the opening credits as Godai collapses to the ground. We cut back. The police are escorting Kazuya away, and Godai is there with Ichijo, and he apologizes for not being able to do anything to stop Jilaji and swearing that he will defeat him next time. And Ichijo's like, look, you did your best. That's all we can ask. We then cut to Nagano, and Sakurako, Kameyama, and Kaneko are on their way to this location. They're driving in the car, the rain's heavy, and Kameyama proceeds to explain that there were 34 victims, all of them with tattoos on various parts of their bodies, and that it seems, from what they can tell, to have been some sort of infighting amongst the Gurungi.
Yeah, they're culling their own ranks.
And that the perpetrator is potentially Lord Raiden.
Our mysterious figure from episode zero.
Do you remember a while back I mentioned the Bay Group?
The Bay Group? Yeah.
We haven't seen any Bay in the show
yet. And now
yet.
We never will.
Hmm.
Guessing that's where we're going with this.
The only one is from a stage show. The rest were killed as part of this.
Hmm.
You wouldn't happen to have a name of that one, would you?
You and your damn Grongy Dex.
Look, it's important to me. You've completed a Pokedex before.
Shut up.
Beejim and Ba the water flea.
Beejim and Gee?
Beejim and Ba. The water bug.
Oh.
We will look up how that's spelled later.
Yeah, I have at least phonetically written down. I'll find an official spelling before I log him in the Dex.
Then it's off to the forest, where La Baruba Day's acid trip has finally hit its peak, because she goes to talk to the glowing forest hole.
She goes into a cave, and
a
talks.
Glowing red cave.
Yes. And just sort of speaks into a further cavern, and she says something like, so you've decided to call the week, and a single light blinks on and off.
It's just a normal stagehand who is just done with everyone's shit.
And she says then she'll go back to Tokyo and continue the game.
And again, the light goes,
yep. And that's all that is. Is this Lord Raiden?
Baruba just went on a fucking vision quest, my dude. She mixed up peyote, Sudafed, and Drano in the turlet and just fucking went ham. She hasn't been sober in 3 weeks.
Man, and I thought I was taking Bada's death bad. Speaking of the other Gurungi, we cut back to their lair, and Gadol is talking with Daldo. Gadol is saying, like, oh, Jilaji's game is almost done, right? And Daldo's like, no, because one of the victims died outside the parameters that were set. So he's had to find a replacement. And this is where we learn Jilaji's parameters. 90 victims, 12 days.
Which just sounds like a... God, I hate to have a solid opinion on what's a realistic number of people you can kill in 4 days, but 90 seems doable, you know?
90 in 12 days. Now, granted, he's doing them in groups, and his killing method takes 4 days to enact, but compare this to Bada's 99 motorcyclists in 7 hours.
Yeah, that's an insane turnaround.
Yeah, I don't like that I'm looking at this. I'm like, yeah, that's a fair and reasonable number for a Gregal.
I've got mixed feelings on myself now.
We've been watching this show maybe too long, Jed.
It's almost over.
It's true.
Don't worry, it gets worse from here.
I need to take a step back and re-examine my humanity.
Need to go to therapy.
No amount of therapy will ever make this moment okay.
No, that's coming up.
Damn, you took us back to Timmy Turner. Jeebus.
Godol asks if there's still enough time left for Jilaji to succeed at the game. And Daldo says if he makes the kill today, or if he initiates it today, that number 90 will die in the time limit. And
one day to find somebody and stab him.
Zelazu, who's standing against a pillar fanning herself this whole time, is just like, oh, don't worry. That's totally within the realm of possibility for Jalaji. He's cautious like that. And this was the moment where I took to interpret cautious as nervous and anxious.
Anxious, yeah.
Which could absolutely play into the him chewing his fingernails down.
Yeah, and being an incredibly effective murderer, but not, as we've seen, a very effective hand-to-hand combatant.
So we cut to the preschool, and Minori is sitting with Hiroyuki, kid number one. And for whatever reason, they have chosen to have this conversation in front of a cardboard Oni costume that I could not stop staring at because it was terrifying.
I was also staring directly at the child the whole time, and I wouldn't want to confess to having a fight in front of the box Oni either.
Correct. It lest it wake up and...
fucking Krampus of this preschool.
And Minori's trying to talk to Hiroyuki, like, you know, you and Shudo were friends once, and you could be again. You just... There's two versions of Shudo, the nice one and the mean one. And if you want the nice one to be around, you have to tell the mean one when he's being mean. Do you think you can do that? And he doesn't give an answer before the other Muppets run in demanding sacrifice.
We'll continue in conversation later. I gotta get on the crane and lower a steer to be consumed by the rest of the preschoolers.
We mercifully do not see that the box Oni has clearly moved since then.
I swear to God, if we don't see that thing in the future, I'm gonna have questions.
I simultaneously do and don't want to see it again. And so we now cut back to Hakone, and we're at the Kanagawa Prefectural Police Station, and Godai and Ichijo are there with Kazuya and a couple, I guess, police doctors?
Sure.
And Kazuya says it isn't fair for us to die like this, and Godai says, you're right, it's not fair, which is why I'm not going to let it happen.
And Ichijo has a look on his face like, dude, don't make fucking promises to the kid. Like, I don't like it either, but damn.
In Godai's defense, if he fails, the kid won't be around to be mad about lies.
That doesn't make it okay.
Calm down. They won't be alive to be upset about it is not a good baseline for human behavior.
No matter how much truth there might be in that statement.
I don't like it, but technically it's true.
This is not a good use of you are technically correct.
This is not the best kind of correct.
I am very uncomfortable with the energy that we've created in the studio today.
You mean the energy that you have created?
Bro, we can't say shit. We had defined opinions on what a reasonable kill count of people in a certain number of days seemed like. We're all bottomed out here.
I apologize for my outburst. So... the police doctor pulls out...
with the assistance of the police nurse.
Pulls out a syringe and says that it's a cocktail of nutrients and sedatives.
Yeah, this is ketamine.
Vicodin and rum.
Night-night.
They're gonna give him this injection, and I don't know why they're doing this.
Yeah, they're sedating the child. Let's be honest.
And even he brings up, he's like, why am I being sedated? Doesn't that put me at a greater risk?
Gotta admit it, kid. You're kind of harshing the vibe in here with all your belly aching, so we're just gonna put you to sleep.
And Ichijo's like, you just have to trust us. Which is a big ask.
I never trust anyone with a syringe. I don't care.
When someone is that nervous, it can have adverse effects on their health.
He's not wrong, but trust me, from a dude holding a syringe is never where you want to find yourself.
So then we cut to a restaurant in Hakone, and there's some drunkards sitting at the table eating and watching the news, and we get a report about the 90 students who have died, although they do bring up that one died via suicide, but they're blaming all of them, including that one, on the ULF, as is right and proper.
Yeah, that's fair. It might not count for the Grongi, but it does count for society.
And one of them, you know, gives the super reasonable response of what's the world coming to? You live in a world where monsters have been doing this for a long time. Maybe you should have asked that question a while ago?
Why haven't any of you moved? This is still happening. It's been, what, months at this point?
Yes. 8 months?
Yeah, I'd move. Like, for a while. If I didn't hear that monsters were killing people anywhere but the city I currently lived in, I might find a different place to chill for just a bit.
And one of the drunks just looks out the front window, and A.T. Field Jalaji is standing there watching the news.
Hi! Just gone.
And he panics and hits the guy he's sitting beside, and the guy is like, what'd you do that for? And he's like, wait, the outside scenery is not grainy anymore.
I honestly don't know what the fuck is up with this scene.
Yeah. We cut back to Kanabe, and Sakurako, Kamiyama, and Kanako have arrived at the most obvious Gurongi lair if you've ever seen one.
There are damp cardboard boxes, leaky ceilings, barrels.
Piles of refuse.
You know, just the whole place looks like the best use of a combat arena you've ever seen. Like, plenty of places to throw Kuga into something.
And there's the persistent buzzing of flies.
Ah, yes,
as they're walking through. And they're just sort of looking around at the trash, piles of debris, as they walk deeper into this facility.
And
then
we
get tonal whiplash.
Oh yeah, we don't quite get to all the blood yet.
No, we don't get to the gore just yet. We cut to Pol-Pol. And John opens the door and pokes his head in. And Pops turns and once again mispronounces his name.
He's doing it on purpose.
And John staring at him and says, nope, wrong again. Pops stares back. And we get a quick cut to Nana.
Who's also staring back.
Well, she's looking back and forth between the two of them. Just, what's going on?
We get a solid, like, 8 seconds of just everybody smiling awkwardly and staring at each other.
And then Jean gives a genuine smile and walks in.
And the scene resumes as normal.
And Pops also then breaks from his weird, stern stare smile to a genuine smile. And he's like, oh, are you here by yourself today? And Jean's like, yeah, Sakurako's out in Nagano. And Pops asks if it's in relation to Kanabe. And Jean's like, yeah, something along those lines, but academic. And Nana's like, oh, this Sakurako's really something, isn't she? And a direct quote. Jean says she's the kind who hangs tough and does a little fist pump gesture as he says it.
He did do that.
And Nana's like, well, I have to become an even bigger big shot than her. I have to be the best actress ever. It's just not that into you. Yeah.
And Pops just names a bunch of hot actresses, and Sean's like, you just named all of my favorites.
At least we have to assume. I don't know who any of these actresses are.
I'm gonna just assume they had a Master Roshi style lecher off right there.
Certainly, because Pops is naming names, Jean's face is getting like brighter and brighter, mm-hmm. until he says that you named all my favorite actresses, and they turn and they clasp wrists like warriors.
And that's
what
enough
a wonderful
joy.
Moment of levity. It's yeah, the last joy. We're getting.
Back to the ditch.
Back at Hakone Precinct, Godai's at a payphone talking to Minori, asking how the conflict between Hiroyuki and Shudo is going. And she's like, well, I talked to Hiroyuki about it. And Godai's like, well, you know, they're kids. They'll sort this one out. I know you did the right thing. And I get there's supposed to be parallels here and showing like, oh no, humans can work out their differences and the Gurongi can't. Yeah, this feels kind of like a weight tied to the episode.
It does.
Godai hangs up the phone. Minori and Keiko are walking and they look into the classroom again and they see that Hiroyuki is sitting in like a reading circle directly behind Shudo. Shudo's looks like he's rummaging through a box of blocks. We cut back to the precinct, and Godai is looking in on a news report where they are naming off the kids who have just died today. And there is a long close-up on his right hand, just clenched. He finally turns and steps away, and Ichijo's there, and they have a brief discussion. And Ichijo brings up that in this particular instance, the values of the Gorongi versus the humans are about as opposite as can possibly be. Godai once again reaffirms that he's going to stop Jalaji.
And I believed him.
We cut back to Kanabe, and Sakurako, Kamiyama, and Kanako have walked further in and
apparently arrived at the set of Dead Space.
This is a charnel house, an abattoir.
There's blood, gore, guts, bits of stuff hanging from the ceiling all over the walls.
This is a fucking kids' show.
They all have handkerchiefs or other things over their mouths and noses to try and block out the stink of it all. And yeah, I'm trying not to harp on it as much because I've gone back recently and listened to our catalog again, and I talk a lot about this as a show meant for 12-year-olds, but this is a show meant for 12-year-olds. And in this time, instead of like taking a good and mature look at a storyline or a subject matter and treating the audience as adults in a way that American television does not, nah, we're just going to show them a fucking bloodbath.
Yeah, this felt more like American television.
Yeah, this one did. It was off-putting. And they come to a particular stretch of wall, and Kamayama's like, I need you to look there. And painted in Gorongi blood is a symbol that looks similar to, but not exactly, the Kuga symbol.
It's got more flared top. It's got a longer extension at the bottom. If the Kuga symbol is supposed to be indicative of like a human face, this one would almost be more lupine, like elongated. It was definitely intimidating. I'll put intimidating in the column.
And the look on Sakurako's face seems to indicate that she has some idea what this particular symbol means.
Ugh. Can you think of anything else that has so much horror involved? No.
Creed. We cut back to the precinct. Sakurai is out in the courtyard. He passes a perimeter guard who is, not joking, just holding a bow staff. I get this is Japan, and I don't know, do the police really carry bows?
I didn't see any police with bow staffs, but they do work very closely with Kuga, so maybe it's all about just having sticks for him to grab if he needs one.
And as he's walking past into the courtyard proper, past a vending machine, we hear the snap, and we briefly see Jalaji standing in a stairwell. Sakurai double takes and turns and goes to the stairwell, and he's gone. You hear the snapping again, and he runs back into the courtyard. We then also cut to inside. Godai and Ichijo are still talking, and Ichijo gets a call over his earpiece from Sakurai saying they've seen an intruder. So Ichijo's like, all right, stay here. I've got to go. And why would you do that?
Yeah, he leaves the door he's guarding. Like, the kid is there. If you and Godai just back-to-back it, you with your war crime bullets, him with all of his different forms and bow staffs and stolen artifacts, they'll probably be okay. But no, Ichijo does what they always do in the movies and goes off to investigate, leaving only one person to guard the door.
We cut back to the preschool, and Minori is still staring in the window at the kids. And Hiroyuki stands up and turns around and goes to face Shudo, and then takes a step back and turns around like he's trying to psych himself up for this. And he turns back around, and he's like, you're a jerk. When you knocked my tower down, that was mean, and I didn't appreciate it, and I hate when you act like this. However, I do still want to play with you. Also, I hate that you just sit there in silence when people try and tell you how you affect them. And Shudo sits there in silence while Hiroyuki is trying to tell him how his actions have affected him.
Like many males I know, the only appropriate way to deal with negative emotions is to pretend nobody brought them up.
The It's what happens when you're not trained on proper emotional regulation techniques. Your options are violent outburst, or let's just keep suppressing until we're by ourselves.
You either choose A, violent outburst, or you choose B until your B quota of suppress it is full, and then it loops right back to violent outburst.
Yep.
So what happens when a whole generation eats lead paint chips. Anyway.
Thank you for that little bit of levity there. We cut back to the precinct, and now we've got Ichijo playing a game of cat and mouse with Jalaji, because he's seeing him for a moment and sprinting around the corner, and Jalaji's not there, and suddenly he's down the stairs, and how do his abilities work?
The world may never know.
This is so disorienting and suspenseful. It's done so amazingly.
And it's got the techno music from the end of the last episode again, which sounds so good and is so hyping, but also, yes, adds that dread.
Yeah, it's weird. It wouldn't have been my first choice. Like, it wouldn't have been what I thought to put with this scene, but it actually does to, like, spike the anxiety a little bit, that high-energy music while everybody's just confused and searching.
Yeah. And he runs into Sakurai and is like, I was chasing someone, they came this way, and he's just like, no, I was chasing someone, they were going that way. And we cut back to Godai, and he's walking away from the door for some reason.
Because he heard the person down that hallway. Definitely over there.
And we cut inside, and Jalaji's in the room with the kid.
Yeah, like sitting next to a dead cop that he just offed. Silently. Godai's still outside the door.
He hears the snap, comes back, throws open the door, runs in. Immediately, no other thought, Henshin.
Just yells it.
Tackles him.
Remember when I said you hadn't seen Godai Med yet?
Yeah.
The fact that just mid-transformation, he doesn't even wait for Mighty Form, he tackles him in street clothes and bursts through the window in Mighty Form.
Both of them have transformed. They hit the ground, and Godai just starts punching him in the face over and over, and we see part of the mouth break.
Mm-hmm. And there's blood flying everywhere, too. It's not just punching a suit. Like, there's blood everywhere. The quills on his head are stained with blood.
Turning red.
Yeah.
And let's go ahead and take this moment. This week's Tropusatsu.
Bum, bum, bum.
Beware the nice ones. Everyone has a breaking point. The kindness of a character tends to be directly proportionate to how dangerous they are when they reach that breaking point, and who in this show is nicer than Godai? We have seen him for the first time truly hit his limit.
Yeah.
It is important to note that the character does have to be genuinely nice. If they're hiding a nasty personality behind a mask of niceness, that's a different trope entirely. And this breaking point, this rage that the character goes into, is often brought on by things like lack of respect, specific taboo, being tried one too many times.
Some kid coming up and rearranging your block tower.
And for Godai, we know he has a particular fondness for kids. He is even more optimistic for them. He believes every child's got a bright future. So to see a Gurungi, because we've seen Gurungi attack children before, and every time it is horrific, but this is one that is particularly targeting children. It's too much. It's the worst thing he could think of. And he hits his breaking point, and this is a rage we have not seen.
Yeah, all I could hear in my head was like, Godai is not home at the moment. Please leave a message after the thwap.
This is brutal. He's not going to Ryder kick or anything like this. His plan is genuinely to just punch Jalaji until the body stops twitching.
Yeah, and Jalaji keeps trying to get away, keeps trying to weasel out. He keeps getting snatched up, grabbed up, thrown against the wall, continues.
Did you notice he begged for mercy at one point?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's new.
We've never seen a Gurungi beg for their life.
Yeah. This is a go, too.
Yeah. Honestly, the one thing I was amazed on, I was genuinely expecting when Jalaji rolled out of the way and Godai punched the wall for his fist to just go through the brick.
I thought so, too. Missed opportunity.
He goes, gets the beat chaser, henshins it, calls the Go-Ram.
And has beat Jalaji so thoroughly in not rising, but regular mighty form. He's beat him so thoroughly, he has time to do all this while Jalaji's reeling on the ground.
As Jalaji's trying to heal.
Yeah.
Transforms the bike, summons the Go-Ram, merges them together into the Beat Go-Ram. I'm sorry, did I steal your thunder for that one? My apologies, I got the naming convention down at this point.
And as we've seen practice before, rams his ass with the Go-Ram to take him somewhere he can explode without hurting anybody.
We cut back to the preschool one final time.
Damn it.
And Shudo gets up and walks over to Hiroyuki and just sort of grabs his hand and yanks him over. And he picks up the box of blocks, dumps them on the ground, sits down, looks at him and is like, no, you're sitting here with me. Hands him some blocks.
We're going to build it right.
And they start building a tower together. We cut to a lake, and Godai stops the Beat Go-Ram, and Jalaji goes flying off it.
Very real, too.
A nice little moment of comedy for what is about to come.
He did the Monster Mash!
The Monster Mash!
We're gonna do it before? Okay.
I don't fuck with child abusers just like I don't fuck with animal abusers. Let's go ahead and cover Dildo. Or more specifically, let Dildo cover me. He's the strong, silent type, but when he speaks, he has a sexy voice. He's a man dedicated to his job, and hopefully brings that dedication to the bedroom. Mash the Condor Man.
Okay.
Did you just skip the porcupine because of the child abuse and name somebody you'd rather fuck?
I respect that.
You know? All right.
Jalaji tries to throw some more of the kunai quills, and Godai silently. This scene is silent.
Yeah, there's not really a whole lot of ambiance or background just going on.
Yanks out the command baton, Titan mode. The quills bounce off. He's walking forward. Jalaji is staggering back, still throwing more and more quills. The belt goes gold, the electricity sparks, he's in rising Titan form. And he wails on Jalaji. Just hacking into him. When we have seen Titan form in the past, it is, if it is not dueling with another blade, will be like the single thrust, or maybe one swing into the stab. No, he is butchering this body.
That was the point hammered home, just how off his rocker Godai is right now. But like every other time we've seen Titan, he's been the Terminator, just walking towards his target, a most efficient motion path to do the thing. That rage has extended into this form. He looks and feels completely different than he has in Titan form previously. Wild swings, just pure rage, just being poured into this villain.
He's a berserker. At this point, it's the only way I can think to describe him. And he hacks and slashes, and Jalaji goes down, and he turns the sword into a reverse grip, and he stabs straight down. But he doesn't stop. He rips. He guts this Gurungi as he explodes. And we get a couple different shots real quick because we get Godai in the explosion, enveloped, and we see what's going on through his mind. The images of the photos of the kids who have died. And the armor changes.
Yeah. In the flames, we get what is clearly an outline of a form we have not seen before.
This is our first glimpse of Kuga's ultimate form.
Etched in flame, in the body of an exploding Grongi, is the final form.
We cut back to Kanabe, just for Sakurako, staring at this sigil. And we cut back to the lake. Godai is untransformed, but he's just standing there, holding the baton, not moving. Still in silence, we get a brief shot of the preschool. Hiroyuki and Shudo have built a rather nice-looking block tower, and all of the other kids are around, and they're, like, cheering, and Minori smiling. Back to the lake, Godai is still standing there when Ichijo shows up. And our to-be-continued, for the first time in the series, is black. My god.
Very strong pair of episodes for sure. Quite a tonal shift from what we've seen so far.
God, what do we want to pick as our ranking?
I'd say snaps.
Snaps? Yeah, I'm cool with that.
So, how do I do 3/4 of a snap?
I'll go first and let you guys collect your thoughts. For design, Jilaiji is all right. His human form doesn't much evoke Porcupine to me. And other than a somewhat androgynous look is fairly unremarkable overall. His monster form, however, is more interesting. Sure, it's mostly black, but the white spines and bone jewelry really pop in contrast. The incorporation of a porcupine's spines into his killing method was also nice. Some cool bits, but we've seen better. 3. I actually really enjoy his behavior. This will overlap a bit with methodology as the two inform each other quite a bit. The tick of biting his nails is a nice decision. The quick darting around and snapping to both distract and terrorize people is very cool, giving the episode a very suspenseful atmosphere. This also makes him one of the most sadistic and cruel Grongi we've seen, actively delighting in the killing more than the game. And then it all comes crashing down when Kuga starts the beatdown, and Jilaiji is reduced to a whimpering, terrified mess. Everything done with him makes this episode 5 out of 5. A few episodes back I talked about the 4 methodologies I remembered from my first watch. This is the final one. And possibly the most cruel to date. Given what we know about the powers of the Grongi, he could expand the needles at any point, but chooses to let his victim suffer for 4 days. He then torments them by appearing and disappearing. And to top it all off, he does this to one subset of middle school students. It lacks the whimsy of some of our other Grongi, especially other Go, and thus seems almost tame in comparison, if not for its cruelty. This gets a 4. That gives Jilaiji an overall score of 4 out of 5.
I'll go next. I think I, too, will start with design. His human form still kinda has the Go. Not quite the right time period, but his is only off by like 10 years, give or take. He has a very 90s vibe to his outfit. Baggy shirt. I realize he was in shorts. He has sneakers on. He's wearing sneakers, of all things. And I don't know why that sticks out to me, but just, I think of the Go, he's the one, the absolute most, I would pay no attention to walking down the street in human form. Other than maybe the fact that anyone who looks at him sees him as grainy and blurry, and that might catch my attention, but for some reason, when we saw the preview and the first glimpse of his Grongi form, I read it as blue, and then you both were like, no, it's black, and I got confused for a moment, but then we watched the episodes, and no, it's very clearly black, so I'm confused as to why I saw him as blue initially.
Sonic the Hedgehog.
I don't know if that would have made it better or worse if he had, in fact, been blue. But yeah, the stark contrast, the white and black, does elevate an otherwise simple paint scheme. The quills along the side of the head do a good job to break up the silhouette and make it more distinct. I'm struggling to think of things to say about it, because other than that, like, it's pretty standard, other than it's black instead of, like, the usual brown or green. 3.5. Behavior. We're seeing such a wide variety of behavior from the go. They have way more fleshed out personalities than the other classes that we have seen so far. You know, we've gotten Burrow the intellectual, Bimu the music prodigy savant, Bada.
Sweet Bada.
Sweet Bada. And now Jalaji, this sadistic, anxious. I don't like saying this, but he feels a bit more human in a way than some of the other Garanji have.
Yeah, you're not wrong. This could be any psychopath. Like, the fact that he's got magic abilities notwithstanding.
It makes me so uncomfortable. He unnerves me in a way that no Garanji has. And I don't have to like something to be able to admit and admire the quality of it. I despise him. But he made me feel more than Burrow did. 4.5? Methodology is horrific. And I guess, like you said, he could kill them whenever he wanted. And he chooses to draw it out, to tell them exactly when they're going to die, and make good on it. Because he enjoys their suffering. And I have to imagine that it's like, because it gets into the brain without leaving any mark on the head. Ugh, the more I think about it, the more squicky it gets. Yeah, I'm going to remember this method for how unsettling it is. Gerudo's was funny, you know, in a horror movie way.
Contextually funny.
Yes, contextually funny. Bada's is just, well, it was Bada, and I will always remember him. Even when I forget Jalaji's name and have lost the Garanji Dex, I'm going to be like the porcupine that was an absolute monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ultimately has to be a 5. That brings my score to a 4.333 repeating.
So you guys both ended up ranking this monster very highly, and I don't think my scores are particularly going to follow suit. So just realizing as you're talking through your analysis, this dumb shit was the reason he failed his own game. He caused too much fear in one of his victims off themselves rather than him being able to activate the quill, so he lost his game because he was a sadistic little asshole.
Yeah.
Womp womp. I'm actually going to start with behavior as well because it's my highest. Behavior I gave out a 4.5 for exactly the reasons you guys mentioned. This character's sadism and tics felt at home in any true crime series. We have a go with a markedly different behavior. Like, we don't see the on-the-nose arrogance quite so much. Like we were just talking about, his indulgence in the game and his indulgence in his own pleasure of waiting and having these people suffer is what cost him his game fundamentally. I mean, for 8 days, this dude's been terrorizing people and killing people, and the cops have not caught up to him or figured it out, and he only failed his game because he was playing too much. That's it. But behavior-wise, exactly on point. That's the kind of oversight the serial killer would have, where they enjoyed their shit too much. And that's generally how serial killers end up getting caught, is they get too into it and they leave something behind because they were enjoying themselves more than paying attention. So that even felt very real. The nervous tick of chewing on fingernails and that going over to the monster also having chewed up fingernails, that was an interesting detail. They specify that the character is overly cautious, and we see this character very much making sure that his kills are lined up before he goes for them. Like, he is fastidious, he is patient, he is cunning. He just likes playing with his food too much, and that's the only reason he failed. So 4.5 on behavior. As far as the design went, I didn't feel it was cohesive. We had some bone affectations and the spiked mohawk in the Garanji form. no real porcupine-esque attributes or nods in the human form that I really saw. Not that much going on. So the design was incohesive. This behavior set and kill method, I feel, would belong in a different and somewhat more sinister animal. Porcupines tend to not be aggressive. They tend to be fairly passive creatures. They'll defend themselves by using their quills when they have to, but they've never been a really aggressive animal. So 3 on design. And then methodology. I will go ahead and bump my methodology up to a 3-5, just because, regardless of the fact the overarching design of the character did not well mesh all of its different components, the methodology itself is abjectly horrifying. Just tagging somebody, letting them know they're going to die, and just letting them torture themselves. That takes my overall score to a 3.66 repeating, of course. Which takes our grand total a 3.99999, so effectively a 4. So 4 snaps.
I'm torn on the drama of these episodes. I'm going to work in reverse order, starting with the C-plot. The murder of Garanji and the scene that Sakurako investigates have some heavy implications as we move into the endgame of Kuga. I understand why the B-plot fits here thematically, but it honestly does nothing for me. More than just thematics, it also serves as something lighter sandwiched between the other two very dark stories going on. But the A-plot is so good. The suspense thriller in nature is such a good way to push Koda over the edge as we continue to explore what it means to fight something like the Garanji. My dislike of the B-plot unfortunately brings this down a bit to a 4.5. One of the highlights of these episodes' cinematography is the grainy shaky cam on Jilaiji, treating him like the killer in a found footage horror movie. But there are a few other standout moments, like the framing and lighting. Igadol switches to monster form and intimidates Goma the practical gore, along with the slightly askance camera on the characters in that scene. How the music dropped out once Kodau's rampage started. I remembered so many of these shots from my first watch, because they are so well done. 5 out of 5. We don't get a lot of fight in this episode, and most of what we do get is Kuga mercilessly beating Jilaiji. I would usually mark it down for that, and still will a bit, but the one-sided visceral curb stomp is the point. This is what Godou is like when he isn't holding back. This is Kuga as a living weapon. The hits have weight. This is one of the few times we see a Garanji bleed in any meaningful way, and it's the only time we see one beg for mercy. That is really more plot-related than the actual quality of the fight, but I can't entirely separate that from my feelings on this fight. A 4 is as low as I can bring myself, despite it not matching my usual criteria. That is 4.5 snaps for the episode.
So, the A-plot is... it's like we're watching a different show. Suddenly, Kuga has gone from action-adventure to a suspense thriller. And man, they did a good job. The sense of unease and anxiety that is woven through the A-plot from start to finish, it's great. The B-plot, like you've said, it's there to try and bring some levity because it needs some levity. The most successful moment of that, though, was Jean and Pops at Pole Pole. I would watch the spinoff of the two of them acting as Waldorf and Statler. That's now their characters in the Muppet AU.
You know what? It is. Well done.
You could roll your eyes, but you know what? I needed a moment of levity for all of this as well, and mine does a better job of making spirits bright than the B-plot did.
Muppets generally do.
Everything is better with Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
I get the need for the B-plot, and I get the subtle lesson there in regards to, like, this is part of what differentiates humanity from the Garanji. But I agree, it didn't do anything for me. It felt artificial, it felt tacked on for necessity. Necessity to the show, not necessity to the plot. And that will drag it down. I guess it is the C-plot, but just these little tidbits of what is to come of Baruba shouting into a hole and a flashlight responding, and the charnel house of I'm guessing the Culling of the Bay. Who knows? This is 34. I guess that's maybe around the amount of a standard group of Gurungi, but there's still over 100 that we haven't accounted for. That's intriguing, to say the least. 4.5. Cinematography is an easy 5 to give. From the first shot of the first episode, with the tracking shot that is low to the ground and angled slightly upwards across the hospital room, to then every time someone is looking at Jalaji and the... It's analog horror. Like, it's meant to look dated, but it doesn't look dated. It looks exactly the way it is supposed to. It's grainy, it's blurry, it's I'm not seeing things correctly. The fact that the show genuinely disoriented me at one point and I started to feel dizzy watching a TV show, that's incredible that they were able to pull that off. A little bit of the CG, Jalaji going flying off the beat chaser, was a bit rough, but then we also got the...
It was bad wire work, not bad CGI.
They still had to edit out the wires, but... one less than stellar effect, but then we also got the preview of Ultimate Form inside the flames. That was awesome. They pulled out all the stops to make sure that the cinematography matched the feel of the episodes. And yeah, that's an easy 5 for me. Combat, I find myself in the same camp as you, because it wasn't a fight, it was a massacre. But that was the point of it, was to be a massacre, and to show us what a Godai without restraint can do. Huh, you know, that whole thing, I was thinking back as we were watching the just vicious murder of Jalaji, to what Tsubaki was saying about, like, there's so much more muscle growth and nerve connections now, and remember, you'll be a biological weapon just like them. Give me a moment, because I don't know how to rank this for a fight. Yeah, it feels wrong to go lower than like a 4, so I think I'm going to go with a 4. So a 4.5, a 4, and a 5, that's easy. That gives me a 4.5 for the episode.
So for me, this is a situation where I wish part of the episode did not exist. I wish the subplot with the two kids was not part of the episode. We didn't... I keep having to remind myself this is written for kids. The children would need the lightning and the break, but for us as adults watching this, there was more fleshing out that could have been done of both Jalaji's kill practices. Like, this episode opened, and as dark as this was, I thought this was going to get darker. I thought this was going to be a situation, and I was dreading it coming, where the porcupine tagged a kid, and that kid still died, with Godai hunting the porcupine, with Ichijo having to watch, with them making a promise to a child and failing them. So I unfortunately have to give what would otherwise be a 5, a 4.5 on plot, just for the inclusion of a B-plot that was more detractory than it was beneficial. Cinematography is a straight 5 immediately. We had incredibly disorientating visual moments. The CGI, with the exception of our little bit of wire work there at the end, was so much better. The explosion at the end felt natural in a way that hasn't very often in this. And they did it while still projecting imagery through the flames to complete the scene. I don't know if you're paying attention, but when the flames faded and Godai was standing there, not only was the grass on the beach on fire, but the rocks were steaming.
I missed that.
They left visual cues from the explosion into the scene of Godai being self-reflective. And it's cherry on top. The atmospherics, the tension, all of it was carefully cultivated, and the cinematography for that reason gets a 5. Fights, I'm not even going to hesitate, I'm giving this a straight 5, because the absolute trouncing is just as important as the fair fight. Because we've seen in this fight what Godai is capable of when he's full of malice, when he takes all of that strength and all of that rage that he has and directs it at a target and does not hold back. Even the Go are begging for their lives. in the first fight between Godai and Jalaji, we got like kind of insinuation of his fighting stack, you know, just snapping around, hit him with a few darts, be somewhere different. He's a skirmisher, but as soon as watching Godai tackle him out of the window while yelling Henshin and crashing into the ground transformed, man, that was fight points right there. Gives me a 4.83 repeating, which gives our episode total a 4.611 repeating. Snaps.
So the next story arc is actually four episodes, but we're not going to try and do four episodes in one. That would be our breaking point. And I don't think you want to hear, you know, just the sounds of us screaming and beating each other. So we're going to split this in half. It's going to be our normal two episodes next week. So join us for episodes 36 and 37, Complication and Approach.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. For $5 a month, you get access to monthly bonus episodes, like us watching Kuga's Hyper Battle DVD.
Your soundboard is getting really robust.
I love it. Keep it up.